Evan Kleiman of Angeli Cafe, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Are your pants a little tight? Before you start your diet, there are 1,001 things you should eat before you start. I'll give you a sample today on the show. The key to making the best hamburgers is to grind your own meat. Really, it's not that hard. And the Portuguese have baked goods that can knock your socks off. A taste of them coming up today. But first, let's see what's in season at the celebrated Santa Monica Farmers Market this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We are happy once again to come across our friend, shopper, and author of the newly released Santa Monica Farmers Market cookbook, Amelia Saltzman, who, as usual, is here at the market shopping, maintaining her level of inspiration and enthusiasm. And here we are talking again. Amelia, now we're getting into the late summer. It's September. I know that you love to focus on seasonal recipes. Tell us what's some fun seasonal stuff we can cook right now.
You know, right now I'm on the hunt for holiday dishes. It's the Jewish New Year, and then several other holidays will be coming up, of course, breaking the fast, Yom Kippur, and then Sukkot, which is the harvest holiday. One of the things I love to do at this time of year is I love to get some of the early fall beets and roast them very simply, but then glaze them with some of the last of the season Valencia oranges and early season pomegranates. So we've roasted our beets, right? We've heated our oven to 375. We scrubbed the beets. We didn't peel them. They're large. We cut them into good-sized chunks or halves. And if they're small, if they're golf ball size, just leave them whole. And just toss them with a little olive oil, a little salt. Cover the pan with foil and roast them, probably about 40 minutes. But once you've got these beets out of the oven, cool them enough to peel. Just the skins will slip right off. Just very simply take 3/4 cup of orange juice, 1/2 cup of pomegranate juice. Just put the two juices in a big skillet. Turn the heat up to medium-high and start to cook the juice down. And it'll start to get syrupy. So after about 5-10 minutes maybe, it will have reduced to 1/2 cup total. And then I would put in all my beet pieces. And then I would just stir those a bit and let the syrup continue to reduce, and spooning the syrup over, and they'll be beautifully glazed, maybe another 2-3 minutes, something like that. And what I would do at the end is I would swirl in a tablespoon of butter, and it just brings the glaze to perfection. I mean, it's just 2 kinds of juice and 1 tablespoon of butter. Now, if you're doing this for the holidays and you do keep kosher, you know, you could do it without the butter, or you could substitute margarine if you needed to. You know, it's a classic way of doing beets and orange.
Mm-hmm.
Citrus and beets go beautifully together.
That sounds so good. That really sounds excellent. Okay, so Amelia, while we have you here, let's talk about maybe another, you know, a side dish that we can use that's going to be using something really special that you have found for us at the market.
Well, this is the time for fresh Sheldons. This is the time for fresh cannellini, beautiful green flageolet. We're so used to just opening a can of cannellini beans, but this time of year is so special. The beans are so delicious. You can make the simplest dish, and it will knock your socks off because of the beans.
Because they're fresh, yeah. Okay, so now how are we going to cook these? We pick our bean of choice.
Pick our bean of choice. So let's say we're going to make the classic white bean salad, for instance, or use it as a side dish with grilled meats at this time of year. So just shell the beans and put them in a pot of water to generously cover. Fresh shell beans do not expand in the same way that dried beans do. So the volume will only increase by maybe 1/4. And just put them on, to medium heat until they come to a simmer, and then just let them simmer partially covered until they're tender. And it could take anywhere from 20 to 40 minutes.
Okay.
When you get really close to the end of the cooking time, add some salt and then turn off the heat, cover the pot, and just let them sit and finish tenderizing in the pot in their liquid. And then it really becomes a convenience food because now you could do whatever you want with these beans and they'll keep cooked like that in your refrigerator for most of the week.
Okay, now for your side salad, what would you do to make your simple side salad?
I would add a little chopped garlic. I would add a little olive oil. a handful of chopped parsley, and a splash of red wine vinegar. And I'd make the salad an hour or two before I was ready to serve it. I could make it even earlier in the day. Mm-hmm. It's just magical.
Fresh beans are the key, absolutely, because it's they're less starchy. They probably have more of the original sweetness and just that natural tenderness.
The texture is delicious in the mouth.
Yeah. Now, when you have your cooked beans in the liquid, now you're going to keep them in the liquid in the fridge if you want to keep them for a while?
Okay. Yes, and you know, the liquid is very nutritious and a wonderful thickener for stews and soups and that sort of thing.
Wonderful. And then, and be on the lookout, too, because more and more farmers are growing more and more of these different kinds of beans.
Well, you know why? Yeah. You know that legumes are a wonderful replenisher of nutrients to the soil. So, you know, one farmer may be growing strawberries and edamame. Why? Because they grow some edamame in order to replenish the soil. It's just good farming practice.
Right, right. Okay, and then the varieties are coming along, and they sell them in or out of the shell, and they're just beautiful to look at, fun to peel, and great to cook with. So.
Yes, and then we'll be heading into dried bean season, and there are a number of farmers, two peas in a pod, and the Spencers of Winrose, of course, who then make a specialty of bringing dried beans. Some of them are the shell beans gone dry, but others are varieties that do better as fully dried beans.
Right. Okay, so fresh shell beans. So be looking for the beautiful pods, and you can shell your own or you can buy them shelled, and then just try this simple recipe and adapt it and use it with tons of different things. Thank you, as always, Amelia, for the inspiration.
Oh, my pleasure.
That was Amelia Salzman. She has just finished and self-published the book, The Santa Monica Farmers Market Cookbook. You can find it in a lot of local bookstores and on Amazon.com. Don't forget to join us at the Pico Farmers Market for the rest of September. We have resurrected our Santa Fe chili roaster, and we are roasting lots and lots of chilies out at Pico. The roaster will be operating from 10 till noon, and we'll be selling fully roasted chilies by the bag. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
I've got a new video podcast available online. In it, I've got two delicious and fast ideas for corn. In this video, I show you how to go beyond the cob. Check it out on kcrw.com/goodfood or on iTunes podcasts. Made a good burger lately? Chances are you brought meat already ground up and sealed in plastic from the store. That meat probably came from many different cows or countries or parts of the animal. One way to ensure delicious burgers is to buy a great cut of meat and grind your own patties. Sound insane? It's really not that difficult. I'll be back with the New York Times minimalist columnist, Mark Bittman, next with tips. That's when Good Food returns. There's something about the combination of meat, bread, and a touch of fresh veggies that completes a sense of satisfaction unlike anything else, I find. So let's muse on the best homemade hamburgers with Mark Bittman of the New York Times Minimalist column. So is it all about the meat?
I actually think you hit the nail on the head when you say the combination of bread and meat. Of course, the veggie thing is California. Here on the East Coast, we, you know, eschew them for the most part. But, you know, I don't know how old I was when I discovered that cutting up meat and then putting it on, you know, pieces of bread was just one of the joys of life. But the hamburger is certainly the epitome of that. Having said that, yes, it's a lot about the meat.
When I was growing up, my mom excelled at making homemade burgers. And she would get ground chuck that she'd put into an onion roll that was toasted and seasoned with melted butter and garlic salt. Oh, my God, it was so good.
The butter is a very interesting touch that some people like.
In those days, I mean, we always used to use this thing called ground chuck, which you never see anymore meat, actually ground beef, labeled as what part of the animal it comes from. It's just all about fat percentage. So what do we do?
Well, it's all about fat percentage because pre-ground meat is often from different parts of the animal and, in fact, from different animals. And I don't know how many different animals. It could be from different countries also. There's just no labeling that controls any of that. So the only way to get ground chuck or ground sirloin, which is very good also, is to buy that cut of meat and throw it in a meat grinder or throw it in a food processor. A food processor does a great job of grinding meat in seconds. So you buy a couple of chuck steaks or a chuck roast, or you buy a couple of sirloins and cut them into manageable pieces and throw them in the food processor, and you make yourself some beautiful burger meat.
And that's what you've decided on, that is the best way. You have to start with grinding your own meat.
Well, if you have a real butcher and you can say to the guy, would you grind this for me? That's fine. But how many people have a real butcher at this point? Not many. And the people in the supermarket are unpacking huge tubes or bags of beef that's been ground elsewhere and putting it in packages for you.
If we're buying our own pieces of meat, either chuck or sirloin, do we have to worry about finding additional fat to add in, or whatever is there, is that fine?
Those are two cuts that generally have fat. I mean, you want to look, especially for sirloin, you run the danger of getting steaks that are too lean because the surface fat is now trimmed to an eighth of an inch or so, so there's not a lot of that. And if there's not a lot of marbling, you could wind up with a burger that's pretty dry, but at least the meat's going to taste good. So it's not that risky. You know, if you wanted to be a purist, you wanted to make the best possible burger, you could add a little pork fat to that. You're not going to really add beef fat, but that's an extreme view of things, I think.
So have you really started using the food processor instead of bothering with the meat grinder?
To start it, I've been doing this for 15 years, I think. I never buy ground meat. And sometimes I have a steak and decide I want to turn it into a burger. But, I mean, you know me. I don't do things just for the fun of it. I don't do extra work because I like doing extra work. This really does make a difference, and it's a way to get much, much better meat in your hamburger.
Since you're grinding it up in the food processor, are you one of those who puts in all kinds of additions?
Some onion or some cumin or some chili, yeah. Maybe some, you know, some bacon isn't bad either. But I grew up with burgers that were essentially just like you, ground chuck on a roll, salt and pepper, maybe garlic salt. And that was kind of it. So it's like pizza. I don't like a lot of stuff on it. I just want that sort of primary experience.
So you're not making sort of like a mini meatloaf recipe that you're then going to either grill or saute?
No, but I do appreciate those. And if other people make them, I'm usually quite happy to eat them, because I'm thinking of, you know, in my neighborhood, there was this woman who put ketchup in her hamburger and Worcestershire sauce and probably some exotic spice like paprika that was 8 years old in that little tan and white can. And I did like that.
I've also found that I really prefer burgers that are griddled rather than grilled. Once you have the meat and you've broken it down and you've added whatever condiments, how do you cook it?
You've roused my curiosity, because you like to get the great browning that you get from a hot pan as opposed to the sort of intermittent browning that you get from a grill.
Yeah, I love when it's just seared.
It's a very good point. It never occurred to me. But I'll tell you, my mother cooked hamburgers in a broiler and did a fine job using that. So it's, if you have enough fat and you have good meat, it's almost the you can't do wrong department. I wouldn't bake them, but still.
Once you find whatever sort of bread thing you're going to do, you've said that the veggie part isn't a big, you know, New York thing. I mean, by veggies, I'm thinking of lettuce.
I know what
and
you think. You have lettuce, tomato,
and
mayonnaise.
and a plethora of grilled onions, please.
Yeah, the grilled onions are good. Again, I have nothing against any of that, but the sort of habit of putting iceberg lettuce and bad tomato on a hamburger does nothing for me. And again, if it's good meat and ketchup and salt, I'm usually quite happy. But I do love grilled onions on burgers.
Okay, I have to go eat a hamburger now.
Yeah, me too.
Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
I love finding out what Mark Bittman is cooking. He writes the minimalist column each week for the New York Times dining section, and he's the author of the wildly successful How to Cook Everything. I'll have a recipe for grinding your own burger online at kcrw.com/goodfood. Speaking of New Yorkers, I know one who knows a thing or two about Italy. My next guest has, like myself, spent over 30 years traveling and studying in Italy. I'll get you ready to book your ticket when Good Food returns. Most of us, even the most sophisticated of travelers, like to have a guide while traveling. Fred Plotkin has written one of my favorites, Italy for the Gourmet Traveler, and it's now back in an updated and revised edition, as is Fred right here and now. It's so great to have you back.
Great to be back. Thank you.
So if you had to pick one region to recommend to a traveler, which would it be?
I am asked that so often, usually in the context of honeymoons, where people say to me, Fred, we're going to Italy, and we know we're going to go to Tuscany, so where should we go in Tuscany? And I always say, wait a minute, are you going to Tuscany because you've heard about Tuscany? Often, Tuscany becomes like a brand, that it's a wonderful region if you love art. And I'm writing a biography now of Michelangelo, so I spent a lot of time in Tuscany. It is not the great gastronomic region of Italy at all. I typically say that the top three gastronomically in alphabetical order are Emilia-Romagna, the capital is Bologna, Liguria, the capital is Genoa, and I just went out of alphabetical order, and Friuli-Venezia-Giulia, the capital is Trieste. But I would quickly add Campania, which is Naples, and Sicilia, Sicily, which is Palermo, and a couple of more. But Tuscany has magnificent wines. It has very good sheep's milk cheeses. But otherwise, it's not the gastronomic destination.
So if we've never been to Italy before, what are the rules of dining that you share with people?
Okay, rule number one. I hate the cliche, but it's true. When in Rome, do as the Romans do, which is to say, throughout Italy, rule number one is never have a cappuccino after about 11 in the morning and never end a meal with a cappuccino. Italians see that as practically an offense. And the reason for that is that the milk in the cappuccino is thought of as heavy and foamy and not a good digestive. If you want to have coffee at the end of a meal and you want a bit of milk, you ask for a caffè macchiato. I mentioned that in Italy for the Gourmet Traveler. That's the main thing. The second thing is, as I advise people in America, eat locally. So that if you are in Perugia and there are good truffles at the moment, that's what you want to have. Eat locally and seasonally.
So don't eat pizza all over the peninsula?
Well, pizza is best in Naples and the area around Naples, but if you're not going to that area, then what you would like to do is try to find a pizzeria in other places that may be run by Neapolitans. I was just in Florence, and one night I really wanted a pizza, and I know of a pizzeria in Florence that's owned by Neapolitans, and they do it the right way. I know up in the Alps of places owned by Neapolitans, and that's where I would go for my pizza. By the way, pizza is only eaten by Italians at night. In other words, the evening meal, not the day meal.
And what a wonderful evening meal it is.
I know. And by the way, with beer or mineral water usually, some people drink Coca-Cola, but I wouldn't. But wine doesn't go with it.
Why?
Because there's something in the grapiness that seems not to pair well with the tomatoes and the cheese. If you were to have beer, there's something malty, there's something slightly fermented in a different way about the beer that goes very well with the crust and with the cheese.
Could you describe the differences between a ristorante, a trattoria, an osteria, and an enoteca?
Okay. An enoteca comes from the word enological, and that means of wine. So it is a place where you can get better than average wines, which in Italy is saying something because it has great wine throughout, but better than average wines by the glass and food intended to go with the wine. A osteria is similar to that, but it's usually run by a host. Now, that may sound obvious, but there's a meaning to that. You go there because you enjoy the pleasant company of the man or the woman who runs it. And part of the evening is the company of that person who will come by, personally refill your glass, put down a plate of something and say, I've been wanting you to try this. There's a friendship component. Not that they're not friendly in other places, but there's that extra component of benvenuto, of welcome, that is very distinct. A trattoria, classically, is a more casual restaurant usually run by families, and you may have a child, and I really mean a 10-year-old, serving you food. not because this is child labor laws that are being violated, but because it's the tradition in the family that they all serve. So you often hear mom in the kitchen, papa out front, just as often as papa in the kitchen and mama out front, and the kids participating in cleaning up. Some of the best food in Italy is in the trattorias. El Ristorante is a place that has more serious aspirations and might be more expensive. But occasionally you get a place that's called a trattoria that is very, quote, upscale. I hate that word. But that is not your typical family place. That said, my rule is if you see a menu outside in four languages, keep walking. Because that means that they are geared toward tourists. It means that they're doing the top hits, but they're not serving what is traditional, typical, and local. So avoid.
Thank you so much, Fred.
Thank you.
Italy for the Gourmet Traveler is Fred Plotkin's book. It's a great guide for eating and traveling through my home away from home. Portugal's a place that gets overlooked in L.A. There isn't a huge community here, but we found an incredible bakery that recreates pastries from this very interesting cuisine. Stay tuned. That's next on Good Food. Creme brulee custard in a crunchy puff pastry. What's not to love? Fatima Marques is here to taunt our taste buds with a discussion of Portuguese pastry. She's from Lisbon, Portugal, and she relocated here over 17 years ago and opened a bakery specializing in Portuguese treats. Hi, Fatima.
Hi, how are you?
I'm wonderful. So before we get into these beautiful little sweets sitting in front of me, tantalizing me, let's talk briefly about food in general in Portugal. How would you characterize the cuisine?
I think it's a simple cuisine compared to most French or Spanish or either or even Italian. But it's the way they make it is just it's made to perfection. So they use very little spices, but what they use, it's just done right. And they specialize in the fish, of course. Of course, I'm partial, but I think Portuguese food is one of the best food in the world.
And it's an olive oil-based cuisine.
Yes, it is. And we have great olive oil.
So now let's go to the treats. Mm-hmm. These beautiful little things sitting in front of me, what are they called?
They're called natas.
Natas.
Yes, we have the esh.
So it looks like natas, but it's natas.
Yeah, it's the plural for nata. Yeah.
And describe it.
Okay. Well, natas is the signature pastry of Portugal. It's a recipe that goes back to the 1700s, Lisbon, Portugal, where I'm from. And so it's sort of like a creme brulee custard in a puff pastry. But the puff pastry is very different than a regular puff pastry. And the creme brulee is not really like a creme brulee. It's a, sort of a, like a creme brulee filling.
Now, the pastry looks almost like a phyllo dough. It looks like it's...
It's very crispy.
Yeah, very, very, very crispy.
A lot of layers.
And you can see the layers at the top.
Yes. What it is that this is made in a special oven. We actually have a Portuguese oven that goes to temperatures around 700 degrees Fahrenheit, so very high temperatures. And all the butter of the dough comes out, so that creates those multiple layers.
And it gives you that beautiful brûléed top.
Yes, mm-hmm. It's baked very fast and very hot.
I have to tell you that this kind of pastry, just a really simple custard in a really perfect crust, has to be like one of my top five sweet things. I love it. This recipe goes back very, very far. Mm-hmm. Is it found the same way that you make it everywhere, or are there personal sort of tweaks and changes to the nata?
Well, not really. The recipe stays the same throughout the years. And you cannot change much of the technique. If you change any little thing, the temperatures, the way you put this in the molds, we have Portuguese molds that have been used for centuries. If you change anything, it changes the whole pastry itself. So people throughout Portugal, they cook it the same way.
So when we eat these at your place, we're getting really a true little
the true taste. Thing.
Are they primarily a breakfast pastry?
No, we eat them all the time, breakfast, lunch, dinner, anytime you feel like having one. For the Portuguese, if we have dessert, we eat dessert, and then we have a nata, which is the top of the creme de la creme
of
the dessert.
So it's not really finished. The meal isn't really finished until you have a nata.
Yeah, either you have savory or you have sweet, you're going to still have the nata afterwards.
Oh, I love that. Is there a strong Portuguese community here in LA?
Not really, unfortunately not.
So how did you come upon the idea of creating this bakery?
I've been here for quite a while. I always felt there was a void, you know, not having a Portuguese restaurant, not having the Portuguese bakeries that I grew up with and all of that. So when I changed careers, I thought, why not do this?
So what else do you have at the bakery besides the nata?
We have plenty of sweets, all the specialties, the nata, the queijada, pastéis de feijão, pastéis de coco,
okay,
malassada.
Slow down and tell us what all these beautiful words mean.
Okay. Queijada is a very popular pastry as well. Queijada, queijo means cheese. So queijada is made from cheese, made ricotta cheese, cinnamon, and other spices. But it's sweet. A lot of people think it actually tastes a little bit like pumpkin. And it's also in puff pastry. Then we have pastéis de feijão, which is feijão is a bean, is a white bean, and we use that to combine with almonds, and so it's glazed on the top and chocolate. We also have pastéis de coco, coconut lemon cupcake, so all of those very popular. Malassada is a very hot item for us, like a donut.
Which many of us think of when we think of Hawaii, but
yeah,
the reason
is because, yeah,
because of the Portuguese immigration,
right,
to Hawaii.
Yeah.
It's so wonderful. So do you also have savory foods?
Yes, we do. The savory, you know, I thought it was going to be a headache, but I had so many requests. So after like half a year being open, people, please, please, please. So I do the three finger foods of Portugal, the most popular. Those are pastéis de bacalhau, which are cod cakes, the Portuguese version of crab cakes. They're made with dry cod, potatoes, and celery, and things like that. Then we also have croquetes, which is seasoned ground beef and Portuguese chorizo, and rissóis, shrimp and crab turnovers.
Wow. So where are you located?
We are on Ventura Boulevard in Sherman Oaks, 13317 Ventura Boulevard. Our cross street is Fulton. So we are right next to all the great restaurants of the valley.
Well, thank you so much, Fatima, for coming by today. I can't wait to break into a nata. They're calling me. Take care and have a wonderful time.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
That was Fatima Marquez. Her bakery is Natas Pastries, N-A-T-A-S. They specialize in these beautiful little custard, crunchy, wonderful things. It's in Sherman Oaks on Ventura Boulevard at Fulton Avenue. I've got a link and some pictures of the pastries on our site at kcrw.com/goodfood. We've all been to banquets before. There's nothing like a large spread of food to make you pile your plate up, even if the food's not that good. The banquet's nothing new. They date back to medieval times. I'll be back next with a scholar of the great courts of late Renaissance Europe. You'll be surprised at some of the food on those immense tables. That's in 1 minute right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Banquets. Now when we think of the word, rubber chicken and endless, boring speechifying tends to come to mind. But many centuries ago, during the late Renaissance in Europe, banquets were something else altogether. Ken Albala, is the author of The Banquet. He covers the transitional period between the heavily spiced and colored cuisine of the Middle Ages and classical French haute cuisine. Hi, Ken.
Hi there.
So give us an idea of what the courts of the late Renaissance in Europe looked like.
A typical banquet, say, in the 1520s in Ferrara, would have had about 50 people, you know, various notables and family members, and set it at various tables. And you'd probably have about as many serving, either pages or carvers or the scalco, who's the official sort of presiding over the whole thing, the manager, let's say. And there are whole books designed for people to learn how to do this.
So he would be like a catering manager.
Exactly.
And the reasons for having a banquet, was it often just to get sort of business associates and family members together, or were they always very strategically planned?
Well, the ones that are recorded in banqueting guides are usually political affairs. You're trying to impress them with the wealth and with the sheer amount of food and the ingenuity.
Would sometimes the real reason to do it, would you ever want to do a banquet to intimidate?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And remember, there's the people who are doing the carving, and carving is a very specific art. In other words, they would hold the piece of meat or whole turkey up in the air, and you brandish what is pretty much a sword. I mean, it's a carving knife, but you brandish that in the air and let the pieces fall very elegantly on the plate. And each table would usually have their own carver. And so, you know, it's only a short step from imagining the guy who is a retainer at court from using this carving knife to using a sword. So there's an implicit threat, I think, in there.
So give us an idea of the kind of food and drink that would be on this table in Ferrara.
Well, there are many courses, usually about 12 or so, and the banquet would last many hours, you know, sometimes 6-8 hours, and you'd have interludes in between courses. So there'd be a musical performance or a play. And what's kind of surprising is we expect a kind of progression of foods. So you'd start with soup, and you'd go to a starter, and then to a main course and dessert. It didn't really work that way. You'd have every kind of food would come out in every single course, so that there would be a soup and sweets and roast and fish in every single course, and so every diner could choose for themselves what they wanted. And it sounds like complete mayhem. You could eat sweets in every course and nothing else if you wanted.
Now, would we recognize any of the food in these courses?
The basic ingredients are familiar. I mean, they really liked white meats, so chicken or capon or light-textured fish or veal are really the favorites. What's different is the spicing. There's tons of spices put on things, and sugar goes on almost every meal. It goes in soups. It goes on, you know, if you have a roasted chicken, you would sprinkle it with sugar and cinnamon.
Is this to disguise perhaps not fabulously fresh food?
Heavens no. That's one of the greatest fallacies of food history, that somehow if you were among the wealthiest of people, you would have food that was going off. Not, absolutely not. The spices are there primarily because people like the flavor. In fact, you'd find ambergris or musk in food also, or rose petals, things like that.
And was the superabundant use of sugar also a way of showing your status?
Yeah, definitely. It's expensive still. You know, I mean, there's this idea that once the Portuguese had gotten a direct trade route to around the Cape, all the way to India and eventually to Indonesia, there's this idea that somehow spices and even sugar, but that would have come from India still at this point, were somehow more abundant or lower in price. They're still very expensive, and they're still markers of status. And to be able to strew sugar on everything is basically, you know, consuming your wealth. It's flaunting it. You know, once the sugar plantations in the New World really get going, then it becomes more abundant, and then you see people lower down the social scale eating more often. And what that does is, for wealthy people, it's no longer so appealing, or it's no longer a mark of status. And I think by the later 17th century, you see people making comments like, you know, only, you know, who would put sugar on a salad? Or you know, it seemed they mentioned that it's sort of an effeminate taste. And then eventually sugar just gets marginalized to desserts, and you really don't see it mixed with savory flavors at all.
Given the incredible abundance and lavishness of a banquet, there must have been a lot of leftovers. Was there a lot of food wasted, or was it given to someone else? Who got the scraps?
Well, people, you know, you see mentioned in many food history books that they gave it away to the poor, and I haven't found any evidence of that at all. My guess, and this is sort of from clues inside the cookbooks themselves, is that, A, you'd have to feed the staff. So there's a huge, as certainly as many people in the household serving as eating, if not more, they would get the leftovers. And in fact, in Bartolomeo Scappi, who's really writes the best cookbook I think ever, but it's the 16th century, writing in Rome for the papacy, specifies that the leftover fat belongs to the cook. It's either to make soap out of, you know, to wash dishes and whatever, but he even specifies the daily apportionment of food that would go to the cook, to the butler, to the pantler, to all sorts of various stations. And the lower down the line you go, the less food you get. But it's clear that there's a lot of leftovers and that there's a very systematic way of apportioning it.
Could you give us a couple of really classic banquet recipes?
Well, my favorite, and this is a lag over from the late Middle Ages, but it's still very popular in the 16th century, is what they call the blancmange, or bianco mangiare in Italian. And I like it because it's so bizarre to our flavor profile, you know, our way of thinking of what tastes good. But it's essentially a capon that's boiled, or chicken, and it's pounded into a smooth paste. And to that is added almond milk and sugar and usually rice starch to bind it, and just a little to make it thicker, and sometimes rose water. And it has this lovely perfumed flavor.
You know what this sounds like to me? This sounds like the Persian dish halim.
Oh, very definitely. And it has connections to the Moroccan bastilla, you know, which is sugar and chicken. And I guess in Europe, that combination just fell aside. And we've lost those flavors entirely. You know, I always think this could be the hot new thing.
It's really fascinating. Thank you so much, Ken.
Thank you.
That was Ken Albala. His book is The Banquet, Dining in the Great Courts of Late Renaissance Europe. Ken is also a professor of history at the University of the Pacific. Speaking of adding spice to your food, there's so many herbs available to us that most home cooks just overlook. Stay with me next for a sample of herbs that should make their way to your plate. That's coming up next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Some books on herbs focus on gardening or recipes, but Gary Allen had a different obsession. His book, The Herbalist in the Kitchen, is a detailed resource guide for foodies obsessed with herbs and their origins. It's a thick book, full of lovely, strange, unpronounceable names. So if you're thinking oregano, thyme, parsley, think again. How about Prosopolis glandulosa and Riscus aculeatus? It's so great to have you, Gary.
That's a very good try, by the way.
I knew that there was no way I was going to bat anywhere near 100% there.
I won't go there myself.
When you were in the process of doing this huge amount of research, were there any total surprises to you in terms of how an herb that you found to be very familiar in the way we use it, or maybe it's used in the Mediterranean, is used in a completely different way in another culture?
Oh, sure. A perfect example is cilantro. Up until maybe 15, 20 years ago in this country, we used coriander seeds, but not the leaves or any other part of the plants. In Thailand, they have different names for the leaves, the stem, and the roots, and they're all used differently.
You say in your book that cilantro, the leaves, tend to be loved or hated passionately.
Yes.
And I find that true, I have to say, as a restaurateur.
Right.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's, you know, for many people, it's just an unfamiliar taste at first. The first time I had it, I was amazed and I loved it. My parents visited Mexico and were horrified to find that there was this taste in every dish they had, and it turned out it was cilantro.
Yes, yeah, some people tell me that it has a very soapy taste, which I've never been able to key into that. How do different cultures use it?
It's used basically at the last minute in most dishes because it just sort of cooks away. It's, you know, to get that fresh quality, you would use it as a garnish or at the very end. An interesting thing is all around the Gulf of Mexico, there are plants with names like cilantro, culantrillo, cilantrillo, and so on, culantro, that are all actually different plants but are used the same way. So what happened is as the Spanish moved around the area, settling it or conquering it, as the case may be, they used whatever herb was similar at the place and carried the name according to its function.
Oh, that is really interesting, which is what causes so much confusion to us now.
Oh, yeah. Common names are the bane of our existence.
Let's talk for a minute about cloves. Cloves are very, very interesting. What is that primary flavor that we get out of cloves?
That's eugenol.
And what is interesting about eugenol?
It has a sweet, perfumey aroma, but it's also pungent and hot. It has an interesting property that it's numbing, so that if you've ever had a temporary filling, you notice this distinctive taste afterwards. It's because they use oil of clove as part of the mixture of that temporary filling. It's numbing, it acts as an anesthesia, and it also prevents bacterial growth.
Is it in any other spice?
Oh, yeah. It's a big component in allspice. It's a big component in bay leaves. It appears in some of the basils.
So if we don't have cloves, could we substitute another herb which has the eugenol in it?
The first one I would go for was allspice because it has the highest eugenol content.
I understand that they're considered to be an aphrodisiac in some countries.
Yeah, that's a really interesting thing. If you've ever looked at a clove closely, what it looks like is a little nail. Obviously, that has a phallic look to it, and that has led to a lot of people believing that it is an aphrodisiac. There are a number of compounds that are marketed as a way of prolonging male pleasure. In effect, what they are is oil of clove, which acts as an anesthesia, so it actually numbs the affected portions.
How interesting. So let's go to another type of pleasure, and let's talk about the plant agave, of which I have had many pleasure from agave.
Good for you.
What are the culinary uses of it?
Well, the only one I know of, aside from tequila, is there's a spice in Mexico called worm salt. And what they actually do is they take the worm, these little agave worms that live inside the sort of bulb-like part of the plant, and they toast them and grind them up with salt and some chilies. And what you wind up with is this sort of smoky, musky taste like tequila in the salt itself.
That's incredible. I've never heard of that. And also, this is the first time I've heard that there's a special kind of worm that lives inside the agave. Is that the same worm that we find at the bottle of mezcal?
That's the one. That's your gusano.
Is the reason it's there then to prove that it came from this plant?
No, actually, it's quite the opposite. The reason it's there is to prove that the liquor hasn't been diluted. If there's enough water in the alcohol, then that worm can actually decompose. If it's perfectly preserved, then the alcohol content is high enough so you know that you're not being cheated.
Gary, thank you so much for spending some time this morning with us. It's really a marvelous reference work.
Thank you. I had a good time.
The Herbalist in the Kitchen is a detailed resource guide that took Gary Allen 12 years to write. I've got a link to his book online at kcrw.com/goodfood. When your pants become difficult to button, snap, or zip, there are two ways to go. First, buy new clothes. But the other way is to go on a diet. But before you do, I want to tell you about 1,001 things to eat before you go on that diet. Stay tuned for some motivation or deviation. That's next on Good Food. If you are looking for a reason to put off starting your diet for a few more days, we've got just the solution for you. 1,001 Things to Eat Before You Diet is a book filled with culinary adventures you might want to try. But contrary to what you might assume from the title, this book isn't packed from cover to cover with naughty treats. Some of Ian Jackman, the author's suggestions, are actually quite healthy. It's a book more about favorite foods, full of soul and love, healthy and otherwise. Hi, Ian. Give us an idea. Let's just start off with a few of the more easily accessible foods that you think most of us don't try at all or don't get enough of.
One of the things that struck me, I was talking to a gentleman in Utah who's a farmer of sheep, and he makes lamb, and it's curious to me as to why people in this country don't eat as much lamb as they might. And it's strange to me that lamb is so much further down the league table, 60 pounds a year below beef and below chicken and turkey. I would eat lamb all the time if I could.
What are some of your favorite ways of having it prepared or favorite places that you've had it?
Lamb in the form of mutton was something that my mother used to make in Irish stew, you know, cheap cuts of mutton cooked with onions and potatoes. That's some of the ways that I like to eat lamb.
What's another food that is definitely out there and is easy for us all to get that we seem to not really want to indulge in very frequently?
Well, so I don't know how easy it is to get, but green chili is something that I ate a lot of in New Mexico. But in other parts of the country, it seems to be treated differently. Maybe it's just the environment. It can't be replicated away from its southwestern roots. But that's another thing I would eat an awful lot more of if I found it.
Well, you know, I have to say that those chilies, which a lot of people think of as being hatch chilies, now with the internet, it's really, you can like get them shipped to you frozen. They're so good.
Yeah, I should definitely try that. There's lots of little shortcuts I have in my book for stuff you can get sent to you through the internet.
Oh, give us some of those. What are some of your favorite things that you love to get on the internet?
My daughter's birthday a couple of years ago, we got some ribs shipped up from Corky's rib joint in Memphis. And of course, Memphis is the home of Federal Express, so they have a handy local shipping operation. They can just stick stuff on one of a number of airplanes, and that was terrific. Frozen custard from Milwaukee. Cops frozen custard in Milwaukee, ships frozen custard, again, in a big box of dry ice. I think you get 10 pints with some walnuts and hot fudge sauce. And that's something you wouldn't necessarily expect to ship well, but it ships fine.
Now, frozen custard, would some of us think of that as ice cream, or is it some other sort of product?
Well, it's a little bit heavier than ice cream. It has less air blown into it, I think, and it has more eggs. So it can have an eggier taste than ice cream, and then gelato is, again, less fat than ice cream. So that's another beast, and I like all of those, I have to say. I've had some great...
As many of us here.
I'm sure, I know. I was just going to say, who doesn't like those things? I had some great gelato very recently. There's a place called Il Laboratorio del Gelato down on Orchard Street in New York that makes fantastic gelato. Basil gelato, banana gelato, black mission fig.
Oh, yum. Let's speak for a minute of things that maybe aren't super healthy. I know that you have a friend in Philadelphia who said that they can take something unhealthy and make it even more unhealthy.
Well, we were talking in the context of the great sandwiches of Philadelphia, like the hoagie and the Philly cheesesteak, and talking about a sandwich that had salami on it, but it was fried salami. And I mentioned that to a friend of mine who's got a lot of family in Philadelphia, and he checked with his cousin and said, oh, yes, there used to be a food cart that he would get his breakfast from, and it was bacon, bacon, mayo, mayo. It's bacon and mayonnaise on a bun that he'd have with his cup of black coffee and a cigarette. So as I say...
Is he still living?
I don't know. I said that sounds like a final meal to me.
Now, what about items that we should embrace that aren't so accessible, that are maybe a little more exotic?
I think the most exotic thing I experimented with was the durian, which is a fruit from Southeast Asia, which I bought at a supermarket in Flushing in New York. And I saw them also in San Francisco, but they're very unusual because they have a tremendously strong aroma, which some people think is beautiful and redolent of, you know, the best of fruits, and other people just think is a terrible stink. And they're banned on the subway in Singapore because of the smell. So I bought one. It was frozen, which doesn't quite work, and took it home to my apartment and cut it open when everybody else was out. And it does indeed have a powerful smell and a pretty strong taste.
Did you like it?
I did like it. I wouldn't say it was the most exciting taste, but it was frozen, so I'd have to get one fresh.
Could you describe this taste? I mean, I've never tasted it and I've never smelled it. And so I try and imagine in my head a smell that is right on the edge between deliciousness and disgustingness, and it's very hard for me to imagine that.
Well, I cut it in half, and it's very difficult to cut because it's tough. It has very prickly spines, and my friend who picked it up in the supermarket and passed it to me, and he pricked his thumb and it drew blood. And he said, well, you have to respect the fruit that fights you back.
I love that. One of the things I love about America is it seems like we have a large population of immigrant tinkerers.
Yes, absolutely. Well, one of the great American dishes would be Cincinnati chili, which is supposed to have been invented by a Greek or Macedonian immigrant in Cincinnati who had a hot dog place. And he was experimenting with minced beef and added some of the spices from home, like cinnamon and chocolate, and put it over spaghetti.
Well, Ian, I want to thank you so much for having such a lovely way of presenting for us things that we should eat before we decide to go on a diet. Ian Jackman is my guest. His book is Eat This, 1001 Things to Eat Before You Diet. I'd love to get your contributions to this list. Email me your favorite foods at goodfood@kcrw.com. I want to see what you'll miss if you had to restrict your calories. If you can't tell yet, I really love history, and history of food compels me even more. When Good Food returns, we'll take a look at how slavery affected the foods of the South and of the U.S. That's coming up next. African-American cuisine has a rich history of survival and evolution. It's a kitchen that has deep roots, extending back over millennia to some of the oldest civilizations on this earth. And yet the African-American table embraces all ingredients from many continents. Much of what we Americans, all of us, think of as deeply comforting, soul-feeding food comes from the African-American table. Jessica Harris is the foremost culinary historian of the African-American table. A collection of her books is really a must for any well-rounded culinary library. I guess my first question would be, when slaves first started to be brought to this country, did they tend to be brought from certain regions in Africa?
I would say, generally speaking, they came from West and Western Central Africa. And certainly many of the earlier of the enslaved would seem to have been from Senegambia, with the trade moving southward as it progressed.
And what were they eating at home before they were rousted out?
Generally speaking, think of a soupy stew over a starch. Now, the starch could be acheke, it could be ablo, it could be fufu, it could be any of those things, including yam mixtures, pounded yams as fufu, plantains pounded again as fufu or whatever, or rice. We hear a great deal about, the Africans brought with them, you know, their okra, or they had seeds with them. And it's like, come on, you got to think about this. And I certainly would have said the same thing probably 30 years ago. But people didn't know where they were going. The whole question and notion of enslavement is such that you didn't get time to pack. You know, you didn't get to bring your treasured items. A lot of the things that the slaves might have been familiar with were brought by the slavers, either on the ships to feed the cargo, the enslaved who at that point were cargo, or on the ships to provision or to try to bring some things to this hemisphere in order to provide provisions for the enslaved.
So how long did it take, in terms of, if we think of this as a timeline, how long did it take for this intermingling of slave and owner to create what we start to think of as being Southern food?
Remember now that as the slaves were, as I sometimes like to say, instantly initiated into the, you know, the nitty-gritty end of the food chain. They grew it, they processed it, they cooked it, and they served it. So that those changes are happening pretty much from day one.
Yeah, because I try and think of the dynamic between a female owner who perhaps has been raised in such a way that she, her hands may have never even really touched food to prepare it, and what she would ask of a house slave to prepare. I would imagine that the slave had an enormous amount of power to create a palate in a way.
Well, absolutely. There's something that they talk about in the cooking of China that they call the wok hand, and it is the shadow, if you will, of the cook. You know, and your listeners know, that if you give someone your recipe and they follow it to the T, it never tastes like yours. That's the wok hand. And that, of course, is what then begins to pervade the kitchens of the South, seasoning that is a little more highly spiced than perhaps others. Okra, not really eaten anywhere else in the country, regionally speaking. Indigenous to Africa, a lot of the things that the early enslaved were eating were similar with many of the things that the Native Americans were eating. And so you see the same kinds of things, wrapping things in leaves. The leaf may no longer be an African leaf. It may become a cabbage leaf. It may become a corn husk. But techniques overlapped in some ways.
Once slaves were able to move about through forced travel or from being freed, how did this southern palate show itself to mingle with other regional cuisines here in the States?
One of the things that I think happens shortly after emancipation is the former house slaves, a fair number found employment on the railroads. And so this is another way of the food moving north and west and around the country. The food is being served by the people who become domestic workers, who cook lunch for the children of the family in some cases.
And then what about on chuck wagons?
Well, absolutely. An extraordinary large population of cowboys, more than we imagine, certainly more than we would think from the films, were African American. When you start thinking about the cowboy stews and stuff, a lot of those cowboy stews were made up of, you know, the, shall we say, less noble meats, innards and things like that. And of course, people who came out of the tradition of enslavement were used to that and knew how to season them and knew what to do with them.
It was really a pleasure to have you. Thank you.
Well, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Take care.
Jessica Harris is a noted food anthropologist and author. I'll have links to her books on our site at kcrw.com/goodfood. You can find info on today's show. You can watch the latest videos of Good Food and also hear past episodes online at kcrw.com/goodfood. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show's produced by Thea Challoner with Bob Carlson, Candace Moyer, Connie Alvarez, and Holly Tarson. The music supervisor is Gary Masiha. Special thanks to Karen Soriano. I'm Evan Kleinman. Please join me next week for another edition of Good Food.